$9.2 trillion a year to get us to net zero by 2050. It sounds astronomical, but what if the cost is a lot less than we thought? This is The Interchange Recharged, a Wood Mackenzie production. I'm David Banmiller. Transforming global energy systems and the economy itself is estimated to cost us over $9 trillion a year. That's $3.5 trillion more than today and about half of global corporate profits. But what if that number is overinflated? What if it costs us way less than we thought? That may be the case. It could be trillions or even tens of trillions of dollars less than forecast. RMI is a clean energy research and advocacy group, and they say that there's a flaw in these estimates, that they don't take into account a decrease in fossil fuel spending. Could these misleading forecasts be impacting the flow of capital into clean energy technologies and influencing government policy?
The key now is to ensure that CapEx moves from generation to grids and from developed markets to emerging markets. The primary impediments to change are policy and expertise rather than the volume or availability of capital.
Kingsmill Bond is a senior principal in the strategy team at RMI. He says it's an unfair comparison to focus on the increase in spending to decarbonize without taking into account the global economic growth and an increase in energy spending that would have happened anyway.
You need to compare apples with apples. And when you compare capital expenditure on energy production for the fossil fuel system with that for the clean energy system, they're both at the moment around $1.1 trillion. Capital expenditure itself is only a fraction of our total spending on energy. So if we're spending $2 trillion in identifiable capex, we're spending $8 trillion a year on our fuels. And a very large part of the gap is the super profits, which we spend on sending money every year to petrostates and others in what the World Bank calls rents. And as we reduce our expenditure on fossil fuels, that frees up plenty of money from no longer paying the rents to be spent on renewable solutions. It's going to be much cheaper.
So if we assume the energy transition is going to cost a lot less than we think, and we might even say it's a necessity no matter what the cost, where is the money going to be coming from? What's impacting the flow of capital, and what are the risk returns?
We have a venture capital downturn in the market. And so when you look at early stage and venture investing, we certainly have seen less capital flowing into the venture side over the last couple of years. But in the scheme of, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, it's a relatively small proportion.
Dan Goldman is a managing partner at Clean Energy Ventures, a VC that funds startups developing early stage breakthrough technologies. What criteria do they look at when analyzing investments? Where are the emerging markets? Let's find out. Dan, thanks for joining us.
David, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start off with just kind of getting an overview, setting the scene. How much capital is actually flowing in to the energy transition?
That's a great place to start. So if you look at the data over the last couple of years, it's roughly about $1.2 trillion per year flowing into climate tech-related investments. And that's across the entire value chain from early stage technology investing, growth stage investing, infrastructure investing, and that covers the entire globe. So we have about half of that capital that is being deployed in China, which is a good thing because China needs to accelerate its decarbonization goals. But when you look at what's the rest of the capital flowing into the US, Europe, emerging markets, you know, $600 billion is not enough. And if you look at some of the reports that have been generated around how much we need to be spending to reduce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, stabilize temperatures at around 2 degrees, I think everyone has viewed 1.5 degrees, which we talked about, you know, over the last couple of decades as really an impossible goal over the next 50 years or so. But we need to be spending, by estimates from Swiss Re, Goldman Sachs, quite a few others, in the range of $6 to $9 trillion a year over the next few decades. And so we are woefully low in terms of the amount we are spending to address climate change. And there are a number of reasons for that we can get into. But suffice to say that if we don't start increasing our spending across the board, bringing new technologies to market, investing in infrastructure, investing in the grid, we have no chance of meeting a 2 degrees stabilized temperatures in the atmosphere.
And what do you think is impacting that amount? I mean, obviously, you know, you just mentioned there's a couple of issues that I see. There's one, the current economic climate that's impacting it. I think there's also some of the areas haven't quite been getting the returns that have been expected. There's obviously government regulation, tax incentives. Some are more clear than others. So there's probably a big pot of reasons, but I'd like to hear you kind of talk about some of your big factors that you see impacting it.
Yeah. So I would say we have a venture capital downturn in the market. And so when you look at early stage and venture investing, we certainly have seen less capital flowing into the venture side over the last couple of years. But in the scheme of, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, that's a relatively small proportion. Where we are seeing a lack of investment is really on the growth stage, where we need hundreds of millions to billions of dollars to scale technologies. And of course, on the infrastructure side, so primarily wind, solar, EV charging infrastructure, improvements to the grid. And even with significant legislation like the Inflation Reduction Act in the US and legislation in Europe, we still see sort of a lackluster deployment expenditures over the last couple of years. I think there are a number of factors that, you know, have been well documented, including the inflationary pressure, the fact that we have higher interest rates, so cost of capital has gone up, and that has certainly impacted the large scale, utility scale wind and solar businesses very substantially. Additions to that include things like supply chain. We've had increases in metals and minerals prices, increases in things like cement. So all of these are impacting the supply chain and complicating the ability to install, for example, in the northeast of the US where I live, offshore wind projects have been canceled because their cost increases have been way above what utilities are willing to pay in a power purchase agreement for 20 years. And so that has really driven, I think, more of a challenging environment for infrastructure development over the last couple of years. Now we're seeing inflation pressure fall and we're seeing minerals prices come down. So the question is, how long will it take for some of those factors to work their way through the supply chain so that we come into a little bit more of a stable environment? We don't see interest rates falling that quickly. They're projected to fall, but they haven't happened yet. But certainly cost of capital coming down would also be a huge impetus to this sector. I think the other thing I'll mention is that, you know, we just have perhaps a risk return challenge. There's not a group of investors out there, I think, that sees the significant opportunity here and willing to invest significant amounts of capital at the current return levels. And so we need to figure out what adjustments are needed, particularly in driving new technologies into the market that are going to allow them to scale using efficient sources of capital.
You mentioned a couple things in your answer that I've talked a number of times on the podcast. I'd love to dig deep into all of them. One is the infrastructure build out, two, the lack of the growth capital, and then the risk return issues that we're having. So let me start out with kind of the growth stage capital. I've always talked about there seems to be a little bit of a gap in that area right now to help some of these companies scale up with the technologies that they have. Some of them have been filled with partnerships with larger corporations, right? But they've got their own issues. They've got their own business. They can't completely fill that gap. So how can we drive some of that investment into that growth stage? Is it partly because there's just a multitude of technologies and people are trying to identify the winners that they invest in? Or, you know, what can we do to push that forward?
Yes, I think it's a great question. And we think about this quite frequently, given that, as you mentioned, we typically invest in low capital intensive businesses, but not all of our portfolio companies are that way. We have some that are in the low carbon cement, building cement plants, in the critical minerals area, recovering minerals from recycling facilities, and a few other companies like hydrogen electrolyzers. So those are all companies that need significant amount of capital to scale their technologies. And I think what we're seeing is, again, going back to risk return, that market adoption and cost competitiveness of these technologies is not quite there yet. And so we see a lot of growth capital sitting on the sidelines, a lot of private equity funding, which would typically be the sources of capital as you're scaling technologies and building out projects, not interested in funding those projects. So what that is driving is more equity capital raises by companies. We've seen a number of companies in the storage space, in the biofuel space, in the e-fuel space, even in the cement space that are raising very large equity rounds, Series B, Series C rounds, to basically fund their business through equity. That's a very high cost of capital way to fund your projects. And so I think what we need to see is more growth capital and more debt capital markets coming into this sector. But, you know, what S2G Builders Vision describes as the missing middle, particularly first of a kind projects and follow-on projects, which are, you know, I think where there's still risk of market adoption, are in fact some of the highest challenges we have in the market today. And I would agree with you that a lot of these investors are simply waiting to see which technologies get adopted and where they want to place their bets. And of course, making sure that those technologies are also competitive in the market.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about the leverage side on it, because you mentioned the lack of kind of debt, and a lot of these companies are being funded purely with equity. In the energy transition in general, how is leverage viewed? I mean, obviously, you've got the capital-intensive companies that are going to need heavy capital, but then you've also got the capital light. And so there's a variation of how financiers look at leverage in the two different companies. But overall, how is leverage seen and pursued in the energy transition?
I think there has been limited use of leverage as new technologies are scaling so far. We are lucky to have Jigar Shah at the Department of Energy working to provide loan guarantees, and that's certainly been a helpful angle. But if you look at traditional debt capital markets that you experienced when you were a banker, I experienced when I was a power project developer, building syndicates among large groups of banks to fund on a, you know, sort of very low cost of capital basis in this market, other than large scale wind and solar using very conventional technology, is very rare. We're just not seeing that happen yet. And I think those lenders are typically looking for much more demonstration of market adoption, strong contractual structures, which are a little bit difficult when you have new technology entering the market, and incentives in some cases to ensure that they have the same risk profile that they're used to in conventional lending, you know, whether it's wind, solar, or road infrastructure or anything else. And I think that's not quite there yet.
And you think part of it is because, I mean, look, the lending in bank world is generally a loss leader in the industry, and banks make up for that with investment banking fees. So you've got an active M&A capital raising type environment. So as part of the reason that the banks are a little bit hesitant is because it's such a diverse market right now, trying to see that winning horse or those winning horses, that they're hesitant to put the loss leading capital first because they're not sure that the fees and the revenue generation, because of the early stage state that the market is in.
Yeah, I can imagine that the opportunities around banking, around IPOs in this market environment over the last couple of years look pretty dim to the commercial banks. And so I think you're right. There may be a view among those banks that, why are we going to lend in a sector that ultimately we may not make very much money on these loans? And there's no prospect of cultivating a relationship with these companies such that there's an IPO down the road, there's hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of equity capital raises going on. I think that could change. I don't want to be too pessimistic about this, because I think we are seeing a number of technologies that are developing and gaining market traction, and they are going to need more efficient capital stacks to make this work. And so I think if we see interest rates moderating, coming down, we see perhaps the equity capital markets opening, we see more M&A transactions, that would lead, I think, to more banks participating in this market. And certainly, I think the developers realize the need for very tightly structured contracts to entice favorable debt capital markets as participating in this sector. Certainly, we have some on the private side, you know, Generate Capital, Vision Ridge, others that, while not providing debt necessarily, are providing equity at the project level on more competitive basis than perhaps corporate equity would be.
Because I know that the capital is there, and the banks have allocated a substantial amount to support the energy transition. And in my conversations with the bankers, you know, there's two issues that they're facing in deploying that capital. Is one, finding the right opportunities, right? There's a lot out there, and they got to find the winners or that's going to make money for their bank and support the energy transition. But two, they're also regulated institutions. And so when companies are in early stage and they're not generating enough cash flow to cover their fixed costs, the bank has to allocate more capital against those loans, and therefore the returns are lower. And so you've got this big initiative being pushed by the government and these banks to put more capital out there to support reducing emissions. but then they also have to answer internally to the regulators that can make it a little bit more challenging, particularly with early stage developing technologies.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. There is going to be an adjustment coming because we have an incredible challenge that's emerging and really has only gained attention in the last couple of months, although I think most geeks in this industry saw it coming. The factors that are driving the need for more capital are demand. Our demand for electric energy is going up quite dramatically. Not only do we see EV adoption increasing, more electrification in homes and businesses, and also industrial applications. But the big elephant in the room is that AI is here, and it is going to expand extremely rapidly in the coming years by all forecasts. And when we think about data center requirements in North America, in Europe, and in other countries, we have a massive electricity demand growth coming, and that is going to require significant infrastructure build out. And so I think if you're sitting on the finance side, whether you're an equity provider or you're a lender, the opportunities that will emerge in order to build out our grid, build out more generation, are going to be very, very significant in the next decade. And if we don't have the capital markets providing that funding, then we are going to have huge problems in terms of our data centers in AI adoption, and costs are going to go up pretty dramatically regardless. So there are a number of structural problems in the market right now that I think are going to contribute toward real challenges with the electricity demand growth. And I think utilities are only waking up right now to the need for capacity additions. We understand that Southern companies revised their resource planning and effectively increased their need for resources by 17x from 1 year to the next. That is a pretty dramatic change in demand forecasting. And I think that's representative of what's happening across the country when you think about, again, data centers primarily, but also adoption of more electrification across homes, businesses, and industrial applications. And again, it's a structural issue that includes both regulatory, finance, and the utilities themselves.
100%. I mean, the data centers are huge consumers of energy, and it's only going to increase. And you've really seen a lot of them take an active role in energy management for those data centers, not only from a clean energy standpoint, but just a more efficient way to manage it. And you're right, it's only going to continue to increase. So something does need to happen. So I wanted to also go on to the other point that you made earlier on, which was the infrastructure. You know, in looking at a lot of these tax initiatives, many of them seem to be focused on the production side of clean energy and not necessarily as much on the infrastructure and the build out necessary for that. I mean, do you agree? And, you know, what can be done to help drive some more of the initiatives to help with that infrastructure build out? Because otherwise, we're going to face a significant bottleneck, which we already are seeing.
Yeah, I think you're right. A lot of them are focused on demand, though there are, you know, I think a significant number of tax incentives for things like green hydrogen, wind and solar, obviously. But also there's a massive number of incentives for improving the transmission system. And so we have a company in our portfolio, Line Vision, which does grid enhancing technologies to help utilities better understand their dynamic line rating, their transmission line health and awareness, and basically gives utilities information so that they can move more electrons across their transmission system. And every study has shown that, you know, as much as 40% increase in capacity can be achieved by very simple grid-enhancing technologies. So these are sensors that you put on towers, you don't touch the lines, and with Line Vision's technology, you can really avoid a lot of new transmission build-out. That said, it's unquestionable that we need more transmission lines. And really what Line Vision does is helps the utilities to understand where they need to build new lines and better understand what they can move across their existing lines. So when we look at something like that, this is not an area that needs a huge amount of investment. Line Vision can do this with relatively low amounts of capital. Utilities can better understand their lines with low amounts of capital. And there are a number of government incentives to help utilities adopt these grid-enhancing technologies. There's also been a FERC order that requires utilities to look at grid-enhancing technologies. So that's an area where we don't need massive infrastructure build-out to understand the lines. We do need massive infrastructure build-out and massive capital deployment to expand our transmission system. It's unquestionable that we need to expand our transmission system for the current amount of generation we have. And of course, current generation, as we have more wind and solar, is in different places than historically has been the case with fossil-based generation. And then, of course, we need to add more wind and solar and other decarbonized power sources across the systems to meet future demand growth. So we look at this and say, hey, this is a great place for government to spend money to help the utilities really understand their transmission system. And so that's an example of an area where we think it's not demand side, it's not supply side, it's really about the structural constraints on the system.
We had Line Vision on the podcast actually a while ago. It was a great discussion. I think the comment that I made after the discussion was it was a no-brainer. You know, it was something that we should definitely be adopting and utilizing more.
Yeah, and the other example I would make is around things like sustainable aviation fuels and biofuels in general, because while there's not necessarily specific demand side legislation or incentives for that, the supply side of it is the thing that's going to enable that. So hydrogen tax credit is a huge impetus to development of green ammonia, sustainable aviation fuel made from hydrogen and CO2. And, you know, so we have a company, OxCCU. It's based in the UK, but, you know, definitely interested in adopting that technology here. And using CO2 and hydrogen, they can make sustainable aviation fuel very cost effectively. But so the incentive around the hydrogen tax credit is critical to scaling up that technology. And again, I think there's some challenges with how the government is implementing the rules around the tax credit in terms of load matching and new renewables and whether the load matching has to be hourly, daily, monthly. The rules are quite stringent as they have originally been released. And I think they really need to consider whether some loosening of that, particularly in the early years, is necessary so that we get greater adoption of hydrogen and can build an industry around it.
It's an exciting time for solar. Advancements in tech, policy support, investment, and the decentralization of solar promise a bright future for the industry. Tax credits are driving investment, and large projects across many U.S. states are grabbing headlines. On The Interchange, we dive deep into the technology and financing that's driving solar growth. We've been joined by industry leaders and experts on the show over the past couple years, and we're back this year to do it again. We'll be in San Francisco on the 12th and 13th of June at Wood Mackenzie's Solar and Energy Storage Summit. As always, I'll be bringing you the debates, conversations, and insights from the industry's leading event right here on the podcast. To secure your ticket, visit woodmac.com/events and subscribe to The Interchange so you don't miss the special episodes coming in June. Look forward to seeing you there. And now going back to the kind of the risk return issue that you had mentioned earlier, I mean, there's been some areas I think that we've seen the returns that have been lower than what is expected at the onset of the investment. Has that caused a little bit of a pause in deploying some of this capital? I mean, there's obviously higher returning investments that are a little bit more stable, you know, with and without tax incentives for people to invest in. So have you seen that impact? And if so, kind of what is the viewpoint now and what are they doing?
I think you can look at returns potentially being lower for projects that were originated, you know, let's say 4 or 5 years ago, and we have a higher interest rate environment. Projects that are being developed now are going to have to contend with that higher interest rate environment. And so I think it's inevitable that, one, there were projects out there that we certainly saw that didn't anticipate the kind of supply chain constraints that were in the market, didn't anticipate kind of the commodity price increases caused sort of like post-COVID. And some of those have really been the key drivers around lower returns on investment. But I think broadly, there is, you know, a future that will provide more stability about returns. And we're certainly looking at some of our projects that are being developed as being able to meet their return thresholds. And ultimately, I think there will be opportunities where leverage can be increased over time. And that will drive improved returns as the projects show that there's market adoption, that they're operating the way they were expected to, and you have good credit around the supply and offtake.
Yeah, you're right. As we talked about earlier, if we can increase the deployment of the debt capital, that obviously will enhance overall returns going forward.
We certainly see a big problem in first-of-a-kind technology deployment, and that's something we've really been focused on as an ecosystem, or sort of really thinking about ways to solve the problem of getting technologies into the market and scaled faster. Because I think if we don't get new technologies into the market faster, we have real challenges in addressing climate change. And so some of the ideas we've had around that, you know, again, I think still to be tested are, you know, insurance products, particularly during engineering, design, construction, and early operations. And then also thinking about, you know, how do you get corporates who can really benefit from these new technologies to try to backstop the tech risk, because they're in the best position in many cases to understand that technology risk, whether you're talking about a cement company, a mining company, an oil company, utility. They really understand the risks in the market. They understand new technologies. And so helping them understand that and try to backstop that risk so that you can get through that construction and early operations stage. Once you get through that early operations stage, you can refinance these projects. You have good credit on the offtake side if you're working with corporates. And we think that's really the biggest challenge. So when we look at new technology adoption and first-of-a-kind technologies, it's really not like something that you need to address for a decade or many years. You need to be able to get that from engineering design through to early operations, year or two of operations. And if that works, then the opportunity to refinance those projects and take capital out of the projects so that you can fund future projects is a real possibility. So we're trying to think about structures working with a lot of philanthropic capital that's very interested in solving this problem. They see it as existential in terms of getting new technologies into the market. I mean, I think there are a lot of good ideas out there to do that.
Yeah, you're right. As you forecast out, once you kind of find that liquidity event, right, that you can refinance, maybe take some of the capital out. I mean, that's when you really look at it and you say, okay, everything's off to the races after that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more, David.
Now, for Clean Energy Ventures, I mean, how do you approach your investments? I mean, what's kind of your investment criteria?
Yeah, great question. So we have a couple hours, right?
As long as you need.
So we are quite deep tech focused. So we typically invest in companies and technologies that have strong intellectual property around them. I won't say that we haven't invested in some software platforms, but it has to be super differentiated in terms of its go-to-market strategy and its lead in the market, as it were. So some of our criteria include, when we look at new technologies, do they have a sustainable competitive advantage? Not that differentiated from any other venture capital firm. But the other thing that's very important to us is we want all of our companies to be able to meet a greenhouse gas emissions reduction metric. So when we look at financial success, that has to be married with greenhouse gas emissions reduction, with an impact metric. And we see those as integrally linked. So if we invest in a company, we think it can grow to scale, be a huge financial success. We want it to be able to have greenhouse gas emissions reduction impact as well. That's huge. And so we use a metric of 2.5 gigatons per company over the period from when we invest to 2050. So a cumulative figure, because many of the companies we invest in are very early stage companies, Series Seed, Series A. You know, they may not even have a product in the market yet. They may not have revenues. That could be pre-revenue. So we look at a more of a cumulative figure because we realize scaling could take some time. So that's one of the key criteria. And again, we think that the financial success of a company and the emissions reduction in this climate tech space go hand in hand with one another. The other thing we focus on intensely is team. So we do a lot of assessments around team with our outside leadership expert, who's an advisor to our firm. And some of the attributes we look for in teams are really, how do they respond to challenges? What kind of culture do they want to create? Where are there gaps in their leadership team that they want to fill? And how can we, as a board director and as an investor in the company, best work to help our companies succeed? And so we are a very hands-on investment firm. And so since we've been doing this since the early 2000s, we've always had kind of the strategy of helping our portfolio companies. And so we really look to invest in companies that are open to having that support. And that support comes in the form of intellectual property strategy, go-to-market planning, financial modeling, capital raising, partnership introductions and development and structuring. So we're very active in helping our companies in a lot of different areas. And I think that's borne out. If you talk to our CEOs, we try to be a helpful investor and a collaborative investor when we invest in companies. But one of the things we also tend to do in our investment diligence is sort of work back from an exit. What does an exit look like for a company? And what does the company need to do to get to that exit? So what milestones do they need to meet at each stage? How much capital do they need to raise? And how many rounds of capital do they need to raise? And, you know, we often sort of talk to investment bankers like you, and we talk to industry participants and try to understand what would an exit look like? How would this company be valued if it gets to a point of scaling? And how would companies who are acquiring this company, we typically focus more on strategic acquisition rather than assuming that the IPO markets are going to be available. How would a company demonstrate differentiated technologies such that it has something valuable to acquiring company? So those are sort of some of the things we look at when we're evaluating companies.
What's your typical investment horizon that you look at?
We want to see a company be able to scale in a 3 to 6 year period because, you know, we're a typical fund life and, you know, typically you need a little bit of a buffer. But from seed or series A, you know, particularly if it's a seed round, it's pre-revenue, it's early technology, maybe pilot project in a lab, you know, then we're looking at kind of a 6 year time frame to exit. And of course, you know, we know that things in this sector have typically taken longer. So we're quite cognizant of reality, but part of our diligence is to really understand what the prospects are for an acquisition in that sort of time frame.
And how does your evaluation process differ when you're looking at maybe kind of a pure technology, capital light investment versus a capital intensive investment?
It's very different because in a capital light, we and, you know, maybe some of our co-investors, whether financial or strategic, you know, can typically fund that company through to an exit. But if we're talking about a capital heavy company, we really need to understand whether the capital markets are going to be open to funding projects or whatever the need for capital will be. And what we typically try to do is think about, well, what's the backup? Because we all lived through the financial crisis. We all remember when the private equity markets were available to fund all the biofuels projects of the 2006 to 2011 period and many other technologies, solar manufacturing. And a lot of that didn't work out the way it had been planned for. And so one of the things we try to think about is if growth capital is not available for a company that wants to build out projects, what is the alternative? Is there a licensing model that might work out where you can license your technology to strategics in the industry and be able to build a significant business that could be acquired? And so that's a really important part of our diligence process is to think about the kind of the backups if the capital markets change, because we've experienced it and we know that it's kind of an unpredictable thing and it could change at any time.
So looking across the energy transition spectrum, the different technologies, wind, solar, battery storage, hydrogen, kind of you name it, are there any that you see more capital flowing into or that's kind of getting their outsized share right now?
I would say rather than like a functional area like storage or wind or solar, I would say the industrial decarbonization focused sectors are receiving, you know, what we see as maybe an outsized amount of technology investment. So we're talking about things like new approaches to making steel, new approaches to mining for metals and minerals, new approaches to decarbonize heavy industry like cement. It would seem that many of the incumbents in that space are feeling the pressure to decarbonize their processes. And so it's quite interesting and I think quite a large opportunity for technologies to have significant impact. So these could be things, like I mentioned, decarbonized steel production or electrifying thermal energy supply, which could cut across many different sectors. There's been a lot of news and investment in the thermal energy storage space. We have a very exciting company called Electrified Thermal Solutions, which produces very high temperature thermal energy applicable to many industries, including the chemicals industry, cement, steel, and by the way, grid scale storage as well. So certainly, I think the industrial decarbonization opportunity is large, it's global, and we see a lot of opportunity there. And I think there's been an increase in investment in that area recently.
And that would make sense. I mean, you've got an established customer base that obviously has a high demand for that, particularly given the environmental pressures that they're on, whether it's their processes or whatever. But that's kind of like a more mature market, so you expect a little bit more capital to be going in there right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say one other area that we see a number of new business models in is really about how to leverage kind of behind-the-meter resources. So distributed energy resources could be storage, could be EV charging, it could be obviously solar, and leveraging that to support the grid. So right now, like, there aren't a lot of software platforms or even programs that can leverage behind-the-meter resources to provide, you know, that power back to the grid in a managed form. And we think with the increase in EVs, increase in storage at the distributed level, there's a real opportunity to take those resources and be able to provide them back into the grid at a cost that can be shared with the owner of those resources, might be the homeowner, it might be a third party. So I think grid-related behind-the-meter resources are increasingly going to become an important area of focus if we can get software that is able to manage them and work with utilities and, of course, utility regulators to bring them to bear in the market. But we see a lot of opportunity there.
You mentioned earlier the amount of capital that is flowing into the sector, like we started out the discussion. And you had said half of that, roughly half of that, is going into China. Are there any other countries that are higher on the list in terms of deploying that capital for this initiative that are doing a good job?
No, I think most of the additional capital is really flowing into Western Europe and North America. We are seeing some focus on emerging markets, and I think it was really good to see at COP28, which I attended, more interest in providing technology and support for deploying decarbonization solutions in emerging markets. And that's something really as more of a side project that we've been very focused on, because we are not going to be able to hit global decarbonization goals without involving the global south and emerging markets to decarbonize. That's the place where, you know, fuels like diesel are increasingly being used because the grid is so unreliable. And so unless we figure out how to transition them to more solar and more decarbonized solutions, it's going to be very hard for us to reach stabilized temperatures in the atmosphere. We see opportunities. We have a company called Spark Meter that's doing digital solutions and metering for microgrids in emerging markets, which increasingly are becoming a pretty large business given that the transmission and distribution systems are not adequate in places like sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia. And so their solutions basically have been shown to improve grid reliance at the distribution level by reducing outages by as much as 30 to 50% over the course of a day, just understanding how to better operate your distribution system. And so Spark Meter is operating in some 15 countries across Africa and Asia with these digital solutions and microgrid metering and software as a service. So that's an area where I think more can be done. And if we can figure out ways to take some of the technology solutions that are being developed in Europe and the US primarily, and do manufacturing in emerging markets, and also provide these solutions to be implemented in emerging markets, I think that'd be incredibly important for us to help decarbonize those countries as well.
That could be a whole podcast series in itself, is how do you support the energy transition in these emerging markets? Because there are so many challenges, and they're unique challenges. And they vary country to country, and they're very different than, you know, what we would face here in North America or Europe or China. And so it is a challenge, but it is good to see that there is becoming more focus on it, because that's going to be required to hit the goals that we have set out.
Absolutely. Totally agree, David.
Well, Dan, listen, I appreciate you coming on the show. Great discussion. I always like to talk finance and finance-related stuff as it relates to the energy transition. So I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to be here.
The Interchange is a Wood Mackenzie production. We'll be releasing the show every second Tuesday, so mark your diaries and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. I'm David Bandmiller. It's been a pleasure joining you. See you next time.